Hello, everyone. It is good to see everyone. Happy Canada Day. So I'll share the source sheet in a second. A few weeks ago, writer Chiner asked me if I would be willing to give one of the shiurim for Canada Day on a theme related to Canada. So I turned to my wife and I said, "What topic should I give on?" So. For those of you who don't know, I'm originally from New York, though I spent 3 wonderful years in Toronto with all of you. But my wife is born in Canada, multiple generations of Canada on both sides. So I asked her, what is a good Canadian topic? And she said, well, I should talk about the different styles of politeness, or lack thereof, between Canadians and New Yorkers. And she told me I should start with the story right after her and I got married, or maybe it was right after we got engaged and I came to Toronto. We were downtown and we were trying to find directions back to the subway, so we stopped someone in the street for a second to ask for directions. And the woman stopped and she said, you know, I'm really sorry, I can't stop to tell you directions. I'm running. I need to catch a bus. And I was like visibly frustrated. My wife asked me, what's wrong? I said, in New York, if someone needs to get somewhere, they don't stop to apologize that they can't give you the time because you have to get somewhere. This woman probably missed the bus because she was apologizing. And it was a very classic New York moment where, you know, we're just used to a certain level of gruffness that is not the case in other places of the world, and definitely not in Toronto. So I thought what I'd talk about is these different styles, because if I had to characterize at least one of the differences between New Yorkers and Canadians, are that Canadians are very, very nice and very polite. Which sometimes for New Yorkers is a bit disconcerting, because you know that they're being nice and polite even if they have something to say to you. And even if they have something that they want to tell you that might not be so nice, but they're polite, so they won't tell you. They'll just think it in their heads. As opposed to New Yorkers, it may be less comfortable to talk to us, but you usually know what somebody is thinking about you, because we're not known for our politeness. We are known for getting straight to the point. So I wanted to talk about these two values. I'm going to share the screen. Should I also... one second. Should I also... did I see a chat? Post the chat. Okay, how should I post it? Can I just... I can do an attachment in the chat here. With the source sheet as well. Chat. Yeah. Though I don't think I can do it with the sheet that I'm currently sharing, right? Okay, I will try to send it out. If not, I will just do it from this file. Okay. I think I'm going to have to do it from here. I'll post the sheet at the end. For people, in the meantime, I have it up on the screen, but I don't think I can do both at the same time. Okay, so a New Yorker in Canada, to be polite or brutally honest. Now, it's not just my feeling that there is this difference. I found this incredible article that was published in 2008 in the International Journal of Sociology of Language, which was on the New York Jewish conversational style. And it's about how, no matter where you are in the world, apparently people can figure out within a few minutes if you are a New York Jew based on the way that you talk. And at the beginning of this article, it noted that evidence abounds of the negative stereotype of New York speech in general and New York Jewish speech in particular. The most widely recognized one of the speeches is, of course, phonology. And they go on to the accent, but they also note that they tend to alienate everyone, right? We have certain bad habits in terms of assertiveness and the like, and the way we talk can turn people off. So this is not just me, but this is something that has been studied by sociologists, which is the difference between the way New Yorkers talk and approach things and the way everyone else does. So if I had to present the two models, right, the New York model, which is we're not necessarily always so polite, but you usually know what we're thinking about you, whether that's good or bad, or the value of being polite at the cost of sometimes knowing for sure what it is that people think about you. So the values on the two sides, on the one hand, the value of the New York style, let's call it, is, as rough as it sometimes is, it's usually pretty truthful. We're not usually scared to say our mind. So the value there is truth. The downside is that you're hurting people's feelings often by being brutally honest. Being polite and sometimes not speaking your mind obviously has a benefit in the fact that it doesn't hurt people, but sometimes there is this concern that perhaps it lacks a bit in honesty. So those are the two values that I want to explore. For those of you who want, afterwards, I gave you at the top here, just for fun, a YouTube clip called Canadians Are Not the Nice Ones, where it's a Canadian comedian talking to a bunch of Canadians, and he says, look, we have to admit Canadians are not the nice ones. I know we're polite, but if you ask an American what they think of Canadians, they always say, oh, they're so nice up there. When you ask Canadians what they think of Americans or New Yorkers, well, in front of them, they might be nice, but behind their back, you know, they may not be as supportive. So these are the two values that I want to outline. So obviously, in value of being honest, shall we say, is the prohibition of being dishonest, which we have here in Source 4, Midbar Sheker, Tirchak, V'naki V'tzadik, Al Ta'arog, Ki Lo Atzdik Rasha, keep far from a false charge, do not bring death on those who are innocent, and in the right, for I will not acquit the wrongdoer. And Chazal classically see in this a broader principle, to not lie, to be honest. But on the other hand, as I said, often being brutally honest can hurt people's feelings, and being polite is a way of making people, of protecting people's feelings, and that's also a Torah value. In general, it's the value of avoiding this principle known as onat dvarim, of painful words. And the Mishnah in Bava Metzia here in Source 5 tells you that just like there's a category of fraud or ona'ah in buying and selling, so too do they apply to the spoken word. And then it gives examples. One may not say how much is the object if he does not wish to buy it. We'll skip down here a little bit. Right, if one is descended from converts, another should not say to him, remember the deeds of your ancestors, for it is said to a stranger, you shall not wrong or oppress. Now here, the convert is indeed a convert, or the descendant thereof, but under the assumption that it would be painful to remind them that they're not a natural-born Jew, there's benefit to not being brutally honest, because it'll hurt their feelings. You see these values on the two sides. But what's but there, of course, we're just talking about holding back from saying something. But the question that we really need to explore is it legitimate to be somewhat dishonest in order to protect people's feelings? Because, as we said, a New Yorker who's being brutally honest often might rub people the wrong way. And being polite, in order to protect people's feelings, sometimes requires us to lie a bit or bend the truth. And, you know, if they say, did I do anything wrong, if you don't want to hurt them, you say no, right? Which is not 100% honest, right? Maybe you think they said something they shouldn't have by accident, so you don't want to embarrass them, but objectively they said something hurtful or wrong. So you say no, you didn't say anything wrong, you didn't do anything wrong. And that is a lie or a bending of the truth that you're doing to protect people's feelings. So is that legitimate? So there are many sources that indicate that it is. That in fact, you're allowed even to lie or bend the truth in favor of protecting people's feelings. The category in halacha is called mishanim mipnei ha-shalom. That you're allowed to change the truth or alter the truth for the sake of peace. The Gemara's classic example comes from number 6. When God tells Avram and Sarah that they're going to have a child, so the Torah tells us, "Vatitzchak Sarah bikirba lemor acharei viloti italiet na v'adoni zaken." Sarah laughed inside of herself. And said, "After I am right, I'm old, I'm withered. Am I going to have italiet na? Will I have enjoyment? Will I have children?" And then she says, "Va'adoni zaken." And how am I going to have a child when my husband is old? He was nearly 100. It was true. But still, it's not nice to say that the reason you're not going to be able to have a child is because your husband is so old. So when God repeats her message to Avram, God says, "Vayomer Adonai el Avraham, lama zeh tzachaka Sarah lemar? Why did Sarah laugh? Ha'af umnam eileit v'ani zakanti, and say, shall I in truth bear a child old as I am?" And he didn't mention the fact that Sarah had placed the main blame of age not on herself, but on Avraham. And from here, the Gemara derives in number 7, the debate of Ishmael Tana, Gadol HaShalom. What you learn from here is that peace is great. Sha'af HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shinabo Dime'ikara Ktiv Adoni Zaken Ublasof Ktiv Vani Zakanti. You learn how great peace is because even the Holy One, even God Himself, departed from the truth because Sarah had said, "My husband is old," and God reports her statement as, "She is old." And here you see pretty explicitly that the Gemara feels that it is legitimate to lie or change the truth in favor of protecting people's feelings, in favor of being polite, courteous, and sensitive. So that's a point, shall we say, for the Canadian versus New Yorker side of the equation. And the Gemara in number 8 tells us that it's not only peace that you can lie for, but when describing what defines a scholar for purposes of returning lost objects, the Talmud says that with regard to these three matters alone, it is normal for sages to amend their statements and deviate from the truth. There are three things that scholars routinely lie about. One, with regard to a tractate, which, as Rashi understands, is if someone says, you know, "Did you study this whole tractate of Talmud?" he's allowed to say, "No." And the Meiri from here derives that you're allowed to lie for the sake of humility, not just this local question, but for the value of humility. You're allowed to lie about puraya, which is something to do with sexuality. The word literally means bed. And ushpiza, which has something to do with lying about hospitality, perhaps underplaying someone's hospitality to not encourage everyone to hound them to host them. But what you see again in this Gemara is that there's a host of different values in which, in order to be humble or modest or take care of other people, we are allowed to lie, bend the truth in favor of people's feelings. And you get this again in a celebrated passage in Ketubot number 9, where the Talmud says that the sages taught, how does one dance before the bride? Meaning, what does one recite while dancing at her wedding? And here, at least at first glance, you get the dispute between the New Yorker, though I would hope no New Yorker would actually be this rude, but you never know, and the Canadian. Beit Shammai says, one recites praises of the bride as she is, emphasizing her good qualities, meaning you call it as it is. If she has good qualities, you talk about them, but you don't lie. And Beit Hillel says, one recites a fair and attractive bride. Beit Hillel says, no, you're allowed to even lie and say she's beautiful, even if she's not. You're allowed to play up how great the bride is, even playing on qualities she has that she may not have. Now, many of the commentaries say that you're not actually lying, because beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and therefore, by definition, this is a subjective category. But you're clearly bending the truth, at least in your perception, and speaking based on the assumption of what you think the husband believes. So there is a certain amount of playing with the truth, but Beit Hillel said that's the right thing to do. And then Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel discuss why it's better either to only say the truth and nothing but the truth, or why it's legitimate to elaborate, change the truth, lie a little bit to make the husband feel better. So Beit Shammai says to Beit Hillel, in a case where the bride was lame or blind, does one say with regard to her, a fair and attractive bride, for the Torah states, keep you from a false matter? Meaning, if there are objective reasons to say that she's not beautiful, are you telling me that it's better to lie just to protect the husband's feelings? And Beit Hillel responds, Beit Hillel said to Beit Shammai, according to your statement, with regard to one who acquired an inferior acquisition from the market, should another praise it and enhance its value in his eyes, or condemn it and diminish its value in his eyes? You must say that he should praise it and enhance its values in his eyes, and refrain from causing him anguish. From here, the sages said, a person's disposition should always be empathetic with mankind and treat everyone courteously. In this case, too, once the groom has married the bride, one praises her as being fair and attractive. And again, the simple understanding of this passage is that Beit Shammai errs on the side of honesty, even if it might create a bit of discomfort. Though obviously he wants to minimize that as much as possible. He says you should try to talk about her good qualities, but he's not willing to lie simply because that's the social protocol, to say, oh my God, the bride looks beautiful. He's not willing to lie, even if that's what's going to make everyone feel good. He says try to minimize the problem by finding good things to say, but you can't lie. And Beit Hillel, perhaps only in this case because of the subjective standards of beauty, but at any rate tells you that he's willing to give up on some understanding of the value of truth in favor of a value of politeness and courtesy and the like. And you find many stories in the Talmud that support this, what we'll call the Canada side of the equation. So just to see a few more quickly, the Talmud in Eruvin 53b tells you that Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya was once staying at a certain inn, and the owner had prepared a meal of beans for him on day one and on day two, and each of those days he ate everything. But then, picking up in the middle of the story, on the third day she oversalted them, so they were inedible. As soon as I tasted them, I withdrew my hands from them. She said to me, my rabbi, why aren't you eating the beans as in the previous days? Not wishing to offend her, I said to her, I've already eaten during the daytime. She said to me, you should have withdrawn your hand from bread and left room for some beans. And here you see that Yeshua ben Chananya was willing to straight out lie rather than tell the woman that her food wasn't up to standard. Now, she happened to have caught him, she happened to have caught him and said, you know, if it's really that you ate already, so then you shouldn't have eaten earlier. But the point is that Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya was willing to lie in order to protect her feelings and just say the food was excellent, which is the nice thing to do. And the Gemara in Brachot goes farther, and it tells the following story. I'll say this one outside. Rabbi Gamliel, after several encounters with Rabbi Yeshua, where he forced Rabbi Yeshua to stand up and humiliated him for disagreeing with Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel was fired from his position at the head of the Beit Din. And when his successor took over, Rabbi Gamliel had a standard that he didn't let people into the Beit Midrash who weren't perfect. Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah sets up as his first policy that anyone who wants to come and learn in the Beit Midrash is allowed to. And immediately they filled up hundreds and hundreds of extra benches. And Gamliel got depressed. And he said, maybe I was wrong in telling people they couldn't come to learn in the Beit Midrash unless they were perfect. and a voice from heaven comes out and says, no, the people who come are not perfect. You were right in what you did. But then the Talmud says that it's not true. In fact, Rabbi Gamliel was wrong for having barred people from the Beit Midrash, but God didn't want Rabbi Gamliel to be sad, so he lied, and he said, you were right, the people that came to the Beit Midrash are not worthy. So you see that even God himself, as we saw earlier, is willing to lie to protect Rabbi Gamliel's feelings. On the other hand, there are other sources in Chazal that support the be honest, even if it's going to hurt someone's feelings, side of the equation. So, if you look at number 12, the Torah says that when the brothers of Yosef saw, they were angry at Yosef because Yaakov loved him more. So the pasuk says, "Vayu echav ki oto ahav aviyem mikol echav v'yishnu oto v'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom." When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him, so they could not speak a friendly word to him. Now, it could be that the simple meaning of this verse, as the Torah Aruch notes in 13, is that they hated him so much that they could never say a good word about him, not in front of him, not talking to other people, and that this verse is criticizing them. However, Rashi quotes a tradition that appears in several places in rabbinic writing that actually says that even though it was wrong for Yosef's brothers to hate Yosef, the fact that they didn't say anything nice about him is actually a praise of them. And Rashi says, "V'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom," they could not speak peaceably to him. From what is stated to their discredit, we may infer something to their credit. They did not speak one thing with their mouth, having another thing quite different in their hearts. And this appears in several midrashim that says that in the end of the day, it might have been wrong for Yosef's brothers to hate Yosef, but it was actually morally respectable that they couldn't bring themselves to falsely say that they liked him. Obviously, ideally, what they should have done was change the way they felt in their hearts. But until they got to that point, the fact that they were unable to lie, they were unable to put on a polite face and pretend that everything was okay, that was actually to their credit, because pretending to be okay with something, pretending to like someone when you really don't, according to this Midrashic tradition, is actually problematic. And I'll just note that the Urayim, Rabbi Elazar of Metz, actually thinks that being two-faced, right, saying, being hypocritical in this way of only saying nice things to somebody's face, but being willing to say not nice things behind their back, that's actually the paradigm of Lashon Hara. That of what we normally think of as gossip, according to the Urayim, the prohibition of Lashon Hara is not gossip, but is actually saying something that you wouldn't be willing to say to somebody's face. So how do we deal with these two poles? We've seen several sources that say it's legitimate to lie or bend the truth, to be polite, to be Canadian, and protect people's feelings, even if that means that you don't tell people what you're thinking. And other sources that said, look, it may not be nice to have problems with someone, but there is a value to being brutally honest in cases when you do. So is there any way of compromising and creating a synthesis between these two sources? To answer this, I want to move to a passage in Yevamot, Samach Gimel, which I actually spoke about at my chasan's tish, which is the first thing that my wife said to me. I spoke about it 9 years ago, before we got married, at the Bayit. And the Gemara tells the following story. Reb Chiya had a complicated relationship with his wife. So the Gemara tells you that when he would tell her to make dinner with lentils, she would make peas. And if he asked for peas, she would make lentils. Anything he would ask for, she would do the opposite just to bother him. So Reb Chiya, when he got older, his son, this was Rav, the son of, this was Rav's wife. So Reb Chiya was his son, and when he got older, he was really bothered by the way his mother treated his father. So what he started doing was he would, if his father told him, "Tell your mother that I'd like lentils for dinner," he would say, "Dad wants peas." And then to anger him, she'd make lentils, and at the end of the day, Rav would get what he wanted for dinner. And eventually, Rav suspected something was weird, so he said to Reb Chiya, "What's going on?" So Reb Chiya told him, "Well, it is I who reversed your request to her." And Rav criticizes him, and he says, "You should not do so, right? Don't lie to her." And he quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says, "They've taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves to commit iniquity. And if you attribute such a request to me, you'll have uttered a falsehood." Meaning it was wrong of you to lie. So all the commentaries ask, and they say, why was it wrong to lie? We know that it's permitted to lie for peace. So if it's permitted to lie for peace, why was it wrong that Reb Chiya was lying to his mother so that she would make the dinner that Rav actually wanted, so that they would have peace between them? What was wrong with what he was doing? It seems to fit the standards of when you're allowed to lie. So the commentaries here divide, and we won't have time to read it inside, so I'll tell it to you outside, and I've given you an English summary. As soon as I'm finished, I will post the source sheet for you to look it over. The Marsha, you know what, I'll run here to an English summary by Rabbi Yitzchak Blau. So he says, the Marsha sees the key as follows. Cite the verse from Yirmiyahu is the key to the answer. The prophet there speaks about learning to prevaricate. A situation in which Chiya would constantly lie to his mother would train him for a life of deceit. While the occasional lie to protect someone's feelings will not have a negative educational impact, an ongoing pattern of falsehood will. Therefore, Rav directs Chiya to stop. And Rosh Hashanah Zalman Orbach takes this farther, and he says, perhaps the problem here was just that Chiya was a child. And children, if you train them to lie, even for good reasons, they may come to believe that lying is okay. So even though technically the lie was legitimate, as an educational model, it was the wrong choice. However, there are two perspectives that I think help us really square the two approaches we've been seeing. One is the Iyun Yaakov. The Iyun Yaakov says, look, you should only lie in a case where you're going to be able to lie to protect someone's feelings and the truth is not going to come out. Because if the truth is going to come out, so then they're just going to be angrier. I mean, therefore you're saying, look, if it happened once, that'd be one thing. But to make a lifestyle of it, you're just setting us up for disaster. But I think the Yamshel Shlomo says something that's even more profound. And Shlomo Luria says, the difference is whether you lie once or it becomes a pattern. And he says the difference is as follows. And this is Rabbi Blau's summary. He says, if a relationship depends on an ongoing pattern of falsehood, then the falsehood is not truly repairing the relationship, but only covering up the fact that something in the relationship is rotten. The occasional lie can be reconciled with a healthy and meaningful relationship, but not a lifetime of falsehood. Rav understands that Chia's strategy does not truly address the tension between him and his wife, and he instructs Chia to desist. And I think that this is really the way to bring the two sources together. On the one hand, it's legitimate in limited circumstances to, shall we say, be Canadian about it, to be polite and bend the truth, to protect people's feelings, to make sure that people don't get angry. But what the Yamshel Shlomo tells us is that that's only in a relationship which is fundamentally healthy. And we all have moments in our good relationships where we know that if we say the truth, the absolute truth, at a given time, it'll hurt someone's feelings, it'll make things worse. So that's legitimate, because it's a band-aid for a small little problem. It's avoiding a problem that doesn't need to be. But if you if it becomes a lifestyle where you lie to protect a relationship all the time to the point where the relationship that you have is predicated on constant minor lies, then the relationship is already poisoned, and there it's worth finding a way of telling the truth and approaching the problem head on. And I think that is a good way of bringing the two different approaches together. To say on the one hand, it's definitely a good thing to be softer around the edges, to be nice, to say things politely and courteously, even if it's not the truth in the absolute sense. But on the other hand, if in order to protect a relationship, you need to be constantly lying because there's really something flawed in the relationship and these constant lies are just a way of pretending that there isn't a problem, so then it's worth biting the bullet, and even if it might hurt, to be honest and then forge a healthier relationship. And therefore there is place to both that honest, even if it's going to hurt attitude that you sometimes find in New Yorkers, and the be polite, even if it's not 100% honest, to make situations better. And both of them really have their place as long as the goal is to maintain a relationship which is predicated on being courteous and kind, but also truthful to the people in the relationship. And I see I'm already over my time, an article by Rabbi Jachter where he suggests from his students at TABC three other suggestions of how to deal with this, but we don't have time for it, so I will share the sources on the chat now so you can look at it afterwards if you'd like. It was wonderful to see everyone and learn with you. I hope you're all enjoying your Canada Day.